2 weeks ago, Virginia elected a new governor and lieutenant governor who are awfully hard to pigeonhole and who seem to have ridden a wave of apparent rebellion against the woke agenda in the schools. And this week, all eyes have been on a Kenosha courtroom. Will justice prevail? And what about President Biden? How did he do it flying the climate flag in Glasgow last week? And finally, how about inflation? Are rising prices the result of President Biden's economic sophistication? You can guess some of the answers to these questions, but there's a lot to talk about here, and it's not all straightforward. So join us as we talk on today's episode of Independent Outlook. Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute here in Oakland, California. We are a stone's throw away from San Francisco, across the bay. And of course, as always, I'm joined by my two very astute colleagues. First of all, David Thoreau, founder and president of Independent Institute. Hi, David.
Hi, Graham. Good to be here.
So glad to see you. It's always impressive to see David sitting in front of that bookcase because it's full of books and journals published by the Independent Institute. And of course, I'm also joined by our colleague, Williamson Evers. Bill Evers is the director of our Center on Educational Excellence, and Bill seems to have a nice book collection behind him too. Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you.
It's great to see both of you. You know, when we were together last, it was, I think, literally 15 days ago, not 14. We had some schedule shifting. Happened to be the day of voting in Virginia and New Jersey and elsewhere. And so we were looking at the indications. I remember that the three of us were talking and making our projections. Turned out we were right, but that's just because we were reading the news, because there were so many reasons to foresee what was going to happen that day. So I was watching the returns, you know. Having lived in Virginia for almost a decade, I was especially interested in some of the material coming out of Virginia. Love to see what Glenn Youngkin said. Very interesting man. But I was especially taken by the newly elected lieutenant governor of Virginia, Winsome Sears. She is an African-American leader and quite a remarkable person, former Marine. She gave a speech at the end where she said during that evening, she said that her father had brought her up here in 1963, I guess from Jamaica it was.
Correct.
And in 1963 was not a great time for African-Americans in the United States. There was a lot of struggle and a lot of unfulfilled promises. Anyway, she said that night, people tell me it's still 1963 in America. And she said, let me tell you, it's not 1963 anymore in America. And, you know, just so heartening to hear that. Any observations about her or the Virginia election, David or Bill?
Well, I think it's fascinating that she's an immigrant. It's true that one of the underlying theses of the critical race theory approach is that there really hasn't been any improvement from the time of slavery. And she testifies, her family testifies to the fact that that's not so. She served in the legislature, the House of Delegates there in Virginia. She served on the State Board of Education. So she's a highly qualified person who's done serious work in Virginia government, well qualified. And she got the nomination. She was, you know, they have nomination by convention. And she was way outspent by someone else who wanted to be the not Republican nominee for lieutenant governor, and she won over the delegates at that convention by giving an eloquent speech somewhat along the lines that you just mentioned about how the American dream had been true for her family and that we should allow channels of achievement, and that she was very serious about that, and a lot could be done in Virginia to further that.
Yeah, pretty remarkable, really. I mentioned that
all these leftists who claim that the Virginia result was racism and white supremacy, they were forced to say that voting for her represented false consciousness because she really was a black white supremacist. I mean, they were just completely tangled up in their ideology.
Yeah, kind of stunning. Reminds us of the some of the politics around the recent gubernatorial recall election in California, which had a little different outcome. But it's very strange how some of the ideologically driven analysts of American life go there. They feel they have to somehow attribute unseen, malign, even unconscious evil motives, even when you're voting for someone like Winsome Sears, kind of stunning. And, you know, I think that that just is not persuasive to the vast majority of Americans, this business of attributing all sorts of malign, unconscious racial motives just did not play that well in the elections, at least. And certainly in Virginia generally, it just didn't persuade.
Especially if the results show that the attempt to stereotype people based on race doesn't seem to empirically pan out. The trend is that Hispanics and Blacks and other dark-skinned people are increasingly moving away from progressivism. And the irony of the further irony of the attack by people like Joy Reid at CNN, who claimed that, let's see, the exact quote was that education is code for white parents not liking the idea of teaching about race. I mean, it's pretty amazing. But the irony here is that what progressives are claiming is that they represent non-white people, but none of these white non-white people have any agency. They can't think for themselves. They can't differ from the progressive narrative. They have to be essentially lackeys for progressivism. And if they differ, then they are attacked. So the progressives are the ones who want total conformity and are the racists. They're claiming that racial identity determines a person, and they dehumanize people like Winsome Sears. And it's just, it's pretty amazing. And I think more and more people are simply seeing through it. The Virginia red wave, which also washed across many places across the country, was essentially parents who are furious about the school closures. They're furious about the hyper-racial divisive teachings of critical race theory. Sex scandals were covered up. And then when McAuliffe and others basically were talking down to the parents that they should have no say whatsoever. And then the National School Board Association works out a deal with the Department of Justice to include parents who are raising questions about these different school board policies and the intolerance that these teachers and teachers unions are demanding, the intolerance that they're demanding that people conform, was the last straw. And so I think that what people are beginning to see is that the Democrats, progressives in particular, have handed the Republicans an election issue that the Democrats cannot win unless they change their policies.
So I would add to David's eloquent and quite accurate reporting there is that the FBI, it has just been discovered, a whistleblower leaked a memo, internal memo of the FBI, and that they've been tagging parents and parent incidents at school boards with domestic terrorism type of tags. This is immediately following on Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, saying in front of Congress, "Oh, we're doing no such thing."
Well, his defense to that was that he said, "Well, we may have used that tag in our internal data marking, but we didn't actually do anything to treat them like terrorists." That's how he's trying to square the circle. When he said, "We're not treating them like terrorists," turns out they were flagging them as terrorists, but then his answer, "We're flagging them, but we're not doing anything with the flagging."
Why okay, flag well them? then don't do it.
Right, don't exactly. Flag them. I know, exactly. Right.
It's sort of like,
they flag Islamic terrorists, they flag people that they think might be involved in kidnapping rings of various sorts. Kidnapping incidents. Okay. But not only is this not a federal crime, it's a local crime if somebody is violent at a school board meeting.
And they should not be violent at school board meetings, to be clear,
They should not be. They should be arrested if they're violent, if they're disobeying you know, statutes about the peace, but it's just, it's very, very deceptive and it's wrong. I mean, all the worries that people had, we have really no provision for a federal police force in the Constitution. And supposedly this was going to be an investigative body that would turn things over to federal prosecutors in federal, you know, things covered by federal statutes that were legitimate under the Constitution. And, you know, not only do we have an increasingly large FBI, increasingly large IRS, we have armed forest rangers, federal forests, agriculture and interior. I mean, this is not what the founders foresaw, and it's not what the Constitution allows for.
The Constitution provides for a system where we have states and localities who make their own judgments.
And they do the police. They have the police power.
That's right. And only a thin
very
national
tiny
level.
Number of things, of right. federal things.
And most people, the polls show overwhelmingly that most people want slavery and other episodes taught in the schools.
Sure.
They're not trying to cover up the history.
That's
what they don't want is to whitewash over this view that people are racially determined as far as their views, and that children are going to be labeled, tagged perhaps, as racist based on their race,
mm-hmm.
and treated as such in this whole woke racial educational system that is being pushed.
Bill, you had a comment. I didn't want to miss it.
Oh, I was just going to have some nuances, but it's fine the way it is.
Well,
we
the thing
go
is,
on to the next topic.
I was glad to see the election results in Virginia, partly as a former Virginian myself, although I'm a native Californian, but I was glad. But I wasn't glad because the Republicans won. I was glad because people won who were turning away from divisiveness. I was glad that Winston Sears won. Not primarily because she's of African ancestry, but because she spoke about unity and how everyone should be treated as a person,
right.
not as a category. These are things that everyone
and
can.
And she's personal testimony to opportunity and the capacity to write. I think, though, getting back to education, there's some other fascinating things that happened recently.
Yeah, tell us.
So one of them is some people decided that they were going to set up their own college in Austin, Texas, that tried to mm-hmm. avoid political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
Another is that we have a form of federally assisted childcare that's included in these Biden big spending bills. And if it goes as it currently seems, religious entities that are providing childcare won't be able to have their staff be people of that denomination or something like that. So let's say you're a Presbyterian church in San Francisco and you have a nursery school in your basement and you want to hire Presbyterians there for some reason. The kids can't come in with any subsidy behind them if you're doing that. Another thing is that they'll have all kinds of space requirements that they're going to put in there, and they're going to have educational attainment requirements that you have to have a BA or that you have to have an Associate of Arts degree or something like that. So this is going to squeeze out some of the current providers, and it's going to hit the religious liberty of people. And a like-minded thing is happening in higher education. So
yes,
the president of the College of the Ozarks had an op-ed column in the Wall Street Journal in which he said that the federal government was going to be going after his school because they don't have co-educational dormitories.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Now, I was at Stanford when my freshman year, so this is, we're talking 1966, 67, long time ago, when coeducational dormitories first came into existence. I don't see why College of the Ozarks, which is a religiously affiliated university, why they have to conform to some bureaucrat's in Washington's idea of
how
to arrange.
The point is to let these institutions figure out how they want to do it. There shouldn't be a czar telling them with federal dollars, you know, to coercively impose it. I mean, some institutions may do well with co-ed, some not, but why should this be determined from on high?
Well, the recent episode at MIT shocked a lot of the alumni, and for good reason. And, you know, this woke...
wokeism. I missed this. What's the detail?
No, David? It was a professor from Princeton who was invited to speak there, and he got canceled.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Dorian, I got it wrong.
He ended up speaking at Princeton.
Right. He's actually from Chicago.
Exactly.
Right. So Dorian Abbott was going to speak, and he's a very distinguished geophysicist. And he was going to speak on topics related to that. But since he criticized this wokeism, so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, he was actually arguing in Newsweek. He said that these initiatives on college campuses violate the ethical and legal principle of equal treatment and treat persons as merely means to an end, giving primacy to a statistic over the individuality of a human being.
Mm-hmm. So he got canceled at MIT.
Right.
And a number of prominent MIT graduates very publicly complained about MIT's behavior. Mm-hmm. I think that was a good sign.
Right.
Yeah, it's a very good sign. But now, you mentioned, Bill, that
the latest development. This is just the latest development at MIT. In some respects, MIT is behind the curve.
Yeah.
Because most other major schools are implementing. Right. That's right.
And that's because MIT is a science and technology institution where, you know, there's a bit of a lag before the progressive bite hits the science and technology fields. But unfortunately, it's arriving there too, which triggers that thing that Bill mentioned. I don't know much about it and don't have too much to say yet, but this institution that's being founded in Austin,
right,
the anti-woke university, somehow I'm a little skeptical. I'm not sure that being against wokeness is a intellectual mission exactly. How about just being a university? Well, I wish them the best, unless you have some comments.
I don't have any particular comments, but there continues to be reporting and opinion columns about the math curriculum in California. So segueing from MIT's concentration on science, math, and technology, engineering, we have a situation where they're trying to politicize math instruction in K-12 in California. And not only has the New York Times reported on it, and there have been letters to the editor in the New York Times about it, Deborah Saunders has done a column about it. The main author of the woke math curriculum in California has tried to defend it. Our open letter on this topic has gone over 1,000 signers.
Not just signers, but certain kind of signers, right?
Right. Yeah, they're Californian. They're in STEM fields. Almost all of them are professors of a science or technology or mathematics or statistics. Or they're business people in that same area, the STEM area, or they're investors in that same area, or they're education officials. A large number are university and college professors.
And if you want to see the letter, it's on our website here, independent.org. Very much worth reviewing.
Show them a little bit of the signatories down there.
Oh, yeah. Well, the trouble with the signatories is that they go on and on and on. I mean,
I know, but just to give them a sense that it's there. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, we're up to almost 1,200 signatories from 67 colleges and universities in California, including all the UC schools, University of California schools, Stanford, Caltech, and others. And so this is no trivial thing. The best people in these fields are saying that this woke math is unfounded, it's a danger, it is incoherent, and it needs to end.
It does. And, you know, the fact is you can look at the list of signatories and you can see plainly that they're not signing it because they're some kind of bunch of right-wing paranoids. These are people of all different stripes who just realize that mathematics is a foundation for so many disciplines and for achievement across the board in American society. And they're just not willing to sit back and let it be degraded this way.
Interestingly enough, also, the last giant controversy we had about K-12 math was Common Core math versus pre-Common Core math. And people on both sides of that debate have signed this.
Yes.
So let's turn the page to something else that's also hot. I warned you about this a few minutes ago. So in Kenosha, this trial has been underway. And I know Bill has some thoughts on this that I want to hear in a minute. But I did watch some segments of the live, you know, courtroom proceedings. It was pretty stunning at the point when the judge dismissed the count of having illegal possession of a firearm because he was under 18 at the time. And this, of course, had been alleged by the prosecution and widely promoted in the media that he had broken a plain fact of law, I mean, this young man, by having a gun at age 17. Well, it turns out that the law was very specific and this particular gun was not covered. So right. The judge withdrew. I'm not saying that the guy...
The government hadn't measured the length of the barrel.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So you think it would be a simple step. But the most stunning thing to me, because you're seeing some of these pictures and the footage. So the prosecuting attorney, he takes this gun and he's aiming it almost at the jury.
He did aim it at them.
I mean, how can you, isn't that abusive?
It is abusive. It's actually an assault.
Yeah. I mean, because
he put his finger on the trigger. That's right. Left that.
Yeah. In the era of Alec Baldwin, how do the jurors know that it doesn't have ammunition in it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, he just wanted to ask them a few questions, like how they were going to vote on the case.
Well, the prosecution went further because the prosecution was basically saying that, making claims that his bringing a gun there meant he had no right to self-defense.
Right.
They said that it was perfectly fine to burn buildings. It was perfectly fine to be chased and threatened. None of that mattered because he'd given up his right to self-defense. And so one of the interesting coincidences here is that, you know, this issue does come down to one of self-defense, the Second Amendment, individual agency, the right to life. And just on November 3rd, the oral arguments were presented in the Supreme Court about a court case on this very issue of the right to bear or carry an arm, and essentially the right to self-defense. And if you can't defend yourself from aggressors, you have no right to life. And in fact, the whole Constitution, Bill of Rights, completely fall apart. You can't speak, you can't assemble, and so on and so forth. So the Second Amendment is not a trivial question, but the prosecution was trying to make claims that simply were unfounded.
Go ahead, Dave, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, I think that the left essentially is outraged by clearly the evidence lining up to support Kyle Rittenhouse. And they believe that essentially the streets are owned by the mob. And for anyone to challenge that is a threat to their ownership of the streets. You know, they can burn buildings, you know, they can make all sorts of wild claims, they can even kill people and not be held accountable. But if someone takes a stand against that, that's totally unacceptable. So the idea of individuals having the right to defend themselves, and this particular young man was asked to come to the city. His father lives there, his brother lives there, but he was asked to come there to protect property, to be essentially a guard to protect property. And he went out of his way to help people. And in every aspect of the videotape that was shown, it's clear that he was being attacked and mm-hmm. chased mm-hmm. and threatened with lethal force.
You know, the thing is, I think the real issue here is the principle of law, because let's say that Kyle Rittenhouse wasn't as benevolently intended as David just described him, hypothetically. Even if that were the case, even if he was an unwise young man who was unwisely running into a dangerous place, it still wouldn't follow that he had no right to self-defense or to carry the gun. We need to distinguish between our perception of the character of the person and the principles of law that govern the actions, and people seem unable to do that.
So there's a couple of things that occurred to me. Just expanding on David's point about self-defense, which is obviously central, and Rittenhouse behavior meets the multi-pronged test for self-defense in the law of Wisconsin. I would tell all of you that the New York Times ran a long news analysis story on how certain scholars are calling the very concept of self-defense itself into question.
Yes.
Wow.
Saying it should no longer be part of the law.
That's right.
That's, as David pointed out, this is a linchpin of all our liberties. So the second thing is the provocation point that David brought up, in the sense of if he brought a gun to the streets, he's automatically surrendering his right to self-defense, and is, that doesn't even belong on the street. So, that's not really the case. And it's also a stand your ground state. You don't have to retreat in Wisconsin. You can retreat. It can revive your status as an innocent party if you're retreating. But so one of the very peculiar things is towards the end of the presentation by the prosecution, they pointed out a picture and they said, look, he's threatening and therefore is a provocation and therefore all his self-defense is waived. But since the time of the evidence being entered in and the court arguments all by both sides being done, it has emerged that the state, the prosecution, had a much more high resolution drone video. And they did not give that in discovery.
They withheld the defense.
And so that was the best evidence. You have to give the best evidence both to the court and when you're doing discovery back and forth, you have to have the best evidence. So they gave them this inferior quality evidence and this blurry thing is what they relied on for their evidence of provocation. So this may be something that, first of all, the jury is asked to see it again and so forth. I'm not following it live, but this may create serious problems for the prosecution.
I think
I
so.
And
going back to the Wisconsin law of the issue of the so-called initiator of force or the person who's the provoker of force.
Right.
Any of those categories do not remove the right to self-defense in this episode. Kyle Rittenhouse actually behaved, according to all the evidence, in a stellar manner, in a generous way, and only under extreme threat.
Right.
Did he respond in kind. And basically the prosecution is saying, unless you're killed, you have no right to self-defense.
Right.
That's a pretty good one, guys, gents. We're dead, but we have all our rights.
Yeah, isn't that great? Wow. I would just say that for all those people who feel that they want justice to be done, it's very important, if justice to be done under law, that it not hinge upon whether we like a person's style or not.
The other thing, criteria. The other thing that's worth mentioning is, of course, the claim by woke racist, again, is that Kyle Rittenhouse was a white supremacist and he was there to shoot blacks.
And maybe that he was killing blacks, right?
Right, exactly.
All the people who died were white.
He only shot white people.
The people he shot were whites. Mm-hmm. The people who were attacking him were whites. Right. And so on any level, this whole thing just totally falls apart. And progressives who think they're going to use this as an example for the need for gun control or to justify rioting. I think the whole thing is totally going to backfire. The news accounts today, in addition to the arrival, I guess, a couple of days ago of 500 members of the National Guard called out by the governor, the news accounts today show that suddenly in strategic places in Kenosha and other cities, great big deposits of bricks have suddenly shown.
Oof, really?
Now, you know, I would be very cautious about this. There have been past reports and previous riots, and it really has turned out to be building materials. I just want to mention, though, that I am not related.
Not in this case, Bill.
Oh,
I am not related to Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Yes, right.
Thank you for clarifying that. We appreciate
well,
that.
Well, it's worth mentioning.
I mean, anyway, my point on that is simply that there's been a lot of threats, and the media almost called for rioting.
If Kenosha doesn't get it, we're going to shut them down. And of course,
right. Unbelievable. And,
exactly.
And the past operational definition of that has been burnings and lootings.
So we hope and pray that's not going to happen. And there is no basis or justification for it in any possible way.
Unfortunately, the newly elected mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, is taking some heat because of sort of side effects of the Rittenhouse trial, among other things. Mm-hmm. He, of course, is a former police chief, I think, if I got that right.
Just policeman.
Yeah, former policeman. Okay. Certainly represents the voters' refusal to defund and delegitimize the police in New York. He's been a policeman. But now he's dealing with these threats from this guy named Walter Newsom, self-appointed leader of Black Lives Matter in the greater New York area.
Even Black Lives Matter are saying we do not take credit, we do not identify with this guy.
Oh, good. Well, he's threatening riots and bloodshed.
Right. Even Black Lives Matter has the sense to disassociate themselves with these
good
kinds of threats. This so-called chapter for Black Lives Matter in New York was started by Newsom, and this is not related to the governor of California.
Right.
It's Newsom with an E at the end, and his wife, and he has a checkered past, to say the least. And New Yorkers are, you know, the reason why Eric Adams was won against a large slate is because of the fact that New Yorkers are fed up with this kind of threat to their neighborhoods, and they want safety and they want justice.
So I would just add that the provocation, supposedly, for doing this is they used to have a plainclothes investigative unit in the police force. And after the riots pertaining to George Floyd's death, the city, particularly Mayor Bill de Blasio, liquidated this unit, and Eric Adams wants to bring it back. And that's supposedly the reason to have So there are, you know, the thing about Black Lives Matter is it's a very, even though there's people who reap tons of money from representing themselves as Black Lives Matter, in reality, it's kind of a very decentralized thing.
Right.
Whoever thinks they are Black Lives Matter and acts on it is in practice Black Lives Matter, but there are also incorporated units that get money from big businesses and stuff like that. Crazy thing, but that is happening. So,
and even though Newsom endorsed a radical opponent of Adams in the election, Adams invited him and had him, you know, met with him, but he was incredibly clear that if Black Lives Matter, we're going to have safe streets, and there's no way we're not going to do that.
Adams, yes.
Yeah,
and have
very
safe streets.
Heartening.
That Eric Adams is not going to equivocate. So I think, and that's why he was elected.
And that's
speaking
just yet.
Speaking of equivocation, we didn't have any of that in Glasgow.
No, everything was as clear as mud.
no hot air, no we'll do something 30, 40, 50 years in the future. And by the way, we'll be gone, long gone.
Well,
the last minute
arrangement that the Chinese and the and India can have coal burning plants, and I think China's adding a new coal burning plant virtually every week.
Yeah.
And China has a lot of coal. The U.S. has a lot of coal too, for that matter. But there's a lot of rhetoric, and the number of private planes that descended there, it was right. amazing.
Huge swollen carbon footprints.
Right. Yeah, now, yeah. One thing I think we should mention here is that carbon is not the problem. Carbon dioxide itself is not a pollutant. It's key to life. It's plant food. And plant food is animal food. And the evidence shows that modest increases in CO2, which have been going on for over 100 years and more, have actually resulted in a greening of the earth, which means longer growing seasons, better crops, and so on and so forth. And this view of carbon being the enemy of life is preposterous. But you can take it further, as we do in our book Hot Talk called Science, is that the science does not support global alarmism, climate alarmism. And it's not alarmism now, and there's no foreseen alarmism that's justified for the future. There are many interest groups that want to push this. There are many people who believe in the claims of climate alarmism, but it's simply not evidential. And so this episode at Glasgow, they have these meetings every year, was a big nothing. And a lot of puffery and a lot of efforts and claims, but it's a pitiful thing in, you know, the age we live in, that we have to endure this kind of fake claims and hysteria over something that cannot be proven to be true. It's really astounding.
So it's interesting. There was, of course, a lot of stuff about the world has come to, we're at the end of the world, everything is blowing up, it's all over. But there was also some interesting response in some of the main media outlets. So one thing was Tom Friedman, who's a longtime regular columnist for the New York Times, and he mostly writes on foreign affairs, but you know, his topic of environmental policy is not too far out of his ken. So his argument is that we need scientists. We need the inventive entrepreneurial types like Elon Musk if we're going to work our way out of this. Now, that was in the New York Times. In the Financial Times, one of their regular columnists, Gideon Rashman, argue that bioengineering, if we come to need it, the way to address this is bioengineering. We should consider sending little bits of flakes of sulfur out into the atmosphere. Well, there are many different ways to do this, but you could send out particles that could reflect back sunlight if that's what you're concerned about. And then the third person in the Wall Street Journal was Bjorn Lomborg. And he had a whole series of articles culminating in the Glasgow meeting. And he said, look, you could do various things like carbon taxes that are not politically palatable to most in most election systems. But you could do other things. You could, if you would make a technological breakthrough so that some kind of non-fossil fuel energy was more cost-effective, then everyone would turn over to it. And the second thing is you could just have general economic growth, because if we're a super prosperous world, we will have the technological base and the mm-hmm. wealth base to overcome problems should they arise. Mm-hmm. I thought those were very common sense. So in addition to all the blather and all the world is coming to the bend, henny penny, the sky is falling, and so forth, we did have some people that had some pragmatic, sober things. And, you know, coming in the New York Times, it's not too shabby to
not
have
bad.
That.
Before you leave Lomborg, you know, we have lots of people with us on this conversation, and sometimes they send in their questions. Just got a comment from Jeff, who's with us right now on the, as we're live, and he's asked if anyone cared to comment on Bjorn Lomborg's new book titled False Alarm. Do either of you know anything about that book, False Alarm?
Yes, and it's a continuation of his earlier books and his newsletter and so forth. And as Bill is saying, to his credit, and Michael Schellenberger and there are others who are saying, okay, well, we'll accept the IPCC claims. What can be done as opposed to shutting down civilization? Right. And so carbon taxes are proposed, and there's all sorts of other things. In our book, Hot Talk Cold Science, we also examine those, as well as other approaches if there is a problem that as far as global warming itself and that being a threat to the environment. My point, though, which is a failure on the part of Lomborg, is that he just blindly accepts what the IPCC is claiming.
I was going to say that you start there, shouldn't
and
you start
there? And that is a mistake, because the IPCC itself is a political organization. We recently had an article published by the co-author of our book, David LeGates, in which he goes after the claim that originally it was 97% of all scientists agree that man-made global warming is an imminent threat. It's now gone up to 99%. And what David does in his article is he just deconstructs all that, showing that the claims are themselves not based on science.
Here's the article. It's on our website, independent.org, also published in Human Events.
And they're not even close. They're not even close to being true. In fact, they're essentially around 1% of scientists believe that this is the case.
He says possibly 0.3% in this article.
Exactly. So a lot, you know, most people are not scientists. Most people don't have the time to follow it. They see this in the news. There are a lot of political and business and environmental interests that are pushing it and have been pushing it decade after decade. And there's billions of dollars to be made from this, just as there is from the COVID vaccines and the mandates of the vaccines. Does that mean that those mandates are justified scientifically, or even the vaccines themselves? That doesn't prove it. So I think that there is, and this all also relates to this sort of modernist view that science is the arbiter of truth in all things. And if someone claims that they're scientific, you have to essentially accept what they say, even if it's not science. So, you know, one of the other areas that to Lomborg and Schellenberger and others credit, they talk about, and we talk about in our book, is the relevance of nuclear power. Nuclear power is part of the portfolio of energy sources that could be developed. In our case, we would want to eliminate the federal laws on limited liability, just as we would on the COVID vaccines, and let them compete and hold them liable. And they have to essentially pay insurance risks and be accountable for what happens. So the problem is, when you socialize any of these issues, or housing, or homelessness, or healthcare, you end up with problems that you never could have foreseen if you let people cooperate and compete and use standards to determine what's true and false. So the slide, and this goes back to the MIT issue. A lot of engineers and scientists that graduated from MIT, and I have many friends who did, are outraged that their school is being politicized. And the politicization, whether it's based on wokeism or some other thing, really is a danger. So it's important that people stand up to it and seek out information that will hold up to scrutiny.
So speaking of David's point about government interventions leading to distortions and things that maybe somebody didn't expect. We did see in the news that the city of St. Paul in Minnesota is moving toward rent control. And this is a popular thing in California as well, so we know about it here. And of course, every time rent control is tried, it fails in the following sense. Fewer housing units are built. Landlords, in order to get into an apartment, you have to have, you have to give, you know, bribes to the landlords. You have landlords not keeping up repairs. You have all the different things that come with incentives to disinvest in the housing stock. So this is already happening in St. Paul, even though the thing is not fully implemented. And people, you know, investors are dropping out of development groups, people who had put in applications for building permits and developmental rights and things like that are withdrawing them. So once again, cutting off their nose to spite their face.
A lot of people say, if only we could keep rents down, then we could help homeless people get rental places.
Well, it's true.
Well, it's also part.
But you got to.
You can do that, but you don't do it by mandating it.
That's right. Exactly. So, the more rent control we have, the fewer housing units get built, which means that the price of housing goes up. If you eliminate rent control, there'll be more housing built, and ultimately supply will go up and the price will go down.
Well, you also need to do some other things. You need to, all the land use regulations that inhibit building need to be attended to. But this is also part of the problem with inflation. So you're seeing rents go up along with fuel costs, food costs, Christmas present costs, everything going up. And so the government reaction is, well, instead of looking in the mirror and seeing that their actions are causing this, they don't want to look at that. They want to impose controls, and which give them more power also. So we do have, if you look at all the countries in the world that have a broad base of money, that broad definition of money, like M2. So the U.S. has the highest increases in prices in the world, but it also has the highest increases in broad definition of money. So here we have all these COVID relief and other big government programs. So that means government debt. So then the government monetizes the debt by having the Fed buy the debt, and that increases the money supply. So not only do we have a supply chain problem that could be handled by deregulation, but we have a serious problem with all these different increases in the money supply, quantitative easing, reduced interest rates, and so forth, that are causing monetary distortions in the economy. And it's going to come, there'll be a correction, and it's going to be ugly when it comes.
I mean, getting back to the housing for a moment, as Bill was suggesting, if a city's housing supply can't grow to meet demand, the natural result is that prices go up.
That's
and
right.
It's true in every area.
Right.
And the supply chain.
But we certainly see it in the Bay Area.
We certainly see it in the Bay Area. And no, we don't want high rents. We want affordable housing. But if you ban affordable housing, which is very commonplace in California, and you restrict new construction, you're going to have higher housing prices. And the justification is often environmental justification. There's the
environmental protection hustle, as a famous book called it.
Right.
But this is also related to homelessness, right, David? If you have all these sky-high rents, it will be one contributor to homelessness.
That's right. The book you're referring to is by the late Bernard Friedan, who was at MIT, by the way.
Yes,
he was. And but on the supply side, I mean, the supply chain issue, California, you know, has two of the major ports in the country through which about 40% of trade comes through, but California ports are uniquely more restricted than ports around the country. And in fact, there are some shippers that are actually sending their wares through the Panama Canal to get to East Coast ports, which are not as backlogged. And the reason why the supply chain problem exists in California is because of a whole number of restrictions. This measure we've talked about before called AB5, right, which bans self-employed owner-operated trucks, the shortage of storage space because of often environmental
land use
restrictions.
Controls, right.
Land use controls, there's restrictions on parking. There is restrictions on warehouses being built.
Union restrictions on automating the ports too.
It's absolutely. Exactly. And it's in the Bay Area, once upon a time, San Francisco was the major port.
Right.
But the unions refused to have container shippers operate. And so what happened is that was shifted across the Bay to Oakland.
Right.
And what they did in San Francisco, they bought out the union members and they gave them all pensions to retire them. And they got this deal and the shipping went across to Oakland. But Oakland is also unionized and they refused to have, as you're saying, Bill, and the AB5 measure that was basically passed by the Teamsters is a serious problem. And obviously it's not just in trucking, it's in many, many different areas. So I think the good news, as we've also talked about before, is that the average person is being clued into the fact that the claims that are made by the proponents of big government, government's the solution to everything, wokeism, progressivism, whatever you want to call it, are not ringing true. They simply do not deliver except for a tiny number of people. And maybe we need to expand the opportunities. One thing that's happened, I think it was just in the last, maybe just in the last year, I forget, is that when Biden was running and Trump were running for office, the polls showed that most people wanted the government to help them more. But in this year, that is completely switched because they've seen the government doing more and they don't like it. Mm-hmm. So I think that we're seeing this sort of grassroots phenomenon spread. And the Biden crowd, the Biden administration, the Biden regime, whatever you want to call it, is tone deaf to this. And they just keep on pushing it. And the more they push it, the more it inflames people's opposition. And it's going to create a gigantic red wave in 2022, is my prediction.
So speaking of the Biden administration, they've sure been putting forth some not very stellar nominees. So in the field of education, in the field of banking and money.
Give us some details.
Okay. Inquiring minds want to know. Also, the Federal Communications Commission. So in education, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Education, these are the people that have done things like put in kangaroo courts for sexual assault cases in higher education. And these are quota type, ethnic quota type people and so forth. So they put in the actual architect of the kangaroo court. They put her back in the civil rights part.
Wow.
So in the FCC, they have a person that they're proposing, and maybe eventually they want to elevate this individual to the head of the Federal Communications Commission.
To be the chair, right.
Yeah. So this individual favors net neutrality, which is price controls on heavy use of broadband. And also that, of course, if you have that, you're going to have distortions. And secondly, favors control over the content of speech. And the third thing is the controller of the currency. So this is kind of maybe the most fascinating case of all. So this woman was educated in Russia during the communist period. She went to Lomonosov Moscow State University. Her name is Omarova. And she favors federal takeover, really, of the banking system. Mm-hmm. And she favors controls over capital investment. So she welcomes small energy companies failing and then having them taken over by some kind of federal Capital Investment Corporation. And so she just basically favors federal control over capital investment. And this, that is a pretty thoroughgoing socialist position.
They say that personnel is policy.
Yes, they say, and they are right when they say that.
That's right. This is essentially nationalization of money and banking and all and people's accounts, their savings, and so on and so forth.
So she hasn't succeeded in doing that yet, but she'll have a perch from which to preach that message.
Right.
She
wants to legitimize it, and she wants to push it because she's a communist. And one of the interesting ironies, by the way, is that Karl Marx was, an heir to the classical economists in certain respects, even though he went off in severe, dangerous territory. But he was pro-gold.
He was.
And so I haven't heard her say anything about that. In other words, if people can own gold, that would undo her entire nationalization scheme.
Speaking of Soviet-educated...
Speaking of communists. No, yeah. I'm not speaking of communists.
Okay, so, speaking of them.
Yes, so the communists are the rulers in Vietnam, both North and South. Mm-hmm. And they have a general who's their minister of public security. And he, like many people, many government leaders around the world, was going to Glasgow to discuss climate change.
But it turns out place to be.
It turns out he did engaged in some culinary tourism as well. And so he went to one of the fanciest restaurants. This is a top communist, by the way, okay? And he went to one of the fanciest gourmet restaurants in London on his way. And so one of the things that they feature there are steaks, juicy steaks, but they put gold flakes on them. Mm-hmm. So they cook the steak and then it's like putting pepper or salt on top. They put gold flakes on the top.
Well, does it taste good?
I can't really answer from any kind of personal experience.
Gold doesn't have a taste, but it's considered to be, sort of a debauched, depraved.
I've heard of conspicuous consumption. This is the most conspicuous I've ever heard.
It's worse than conspicuous consumption.
It costs such a meal costs between $1,500 and $2,500.
Right.
Wow.
So this guy is representative of a fairly poor country, and he's nominally a socialist. He's nominally, against kind of things like this, I suppose. But there's rules for thee, and there's special exceptions for me. And as George Orwell once put it in discussing the socialist nomenclatura of the Animal Farm, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. And this Vietnamese communist sure approved that one.
Well, but on a deeper level, it seems to me that, hypocrisy can be found anywhere. But the point I think that's more important is that in systems that pivot on socialist principles, where there's a high concentration of command and control authority to implement the great vision of equality, it inevitably produces a class, politically dominant class, who inevitably fall into a form of self-aggrandizement. This is not some kind of a betrayal of the system. This is a well-known and perpetually reenacted feature of socialist systems.
Exactly. Yes. I think that's an excellent point.
Right. And so you have this collectivist horde of the masses, and they're being dictated by the elite, who allegedly are in sync with historicist processes to lead the society to the future.
Allegedly.
Yeah. And in other words, in the name of egalitarianism, you've created a total tyranny.
Yep.
And the people at the top, as you're saying, take advantage of it.
Inevitably.
All systems have been like that, whether it's ancient Babylon or whatever.
We need to bring this to a close today, but very quickly, I want to point out that we've been busy here at Independent Institute trying to follow these issues for you and doing in-depth research on a variety of things. One of the things we've been working on recently is a new approach to handling the very fraught question of homelessness in California and elsewhere. And I want to bring to the attention of our friends across the country who are with us today that it's very much worth going to our website and seeing this report that we have just launched called Beyond Homeless, Good Intentions, Bad Outcomes, Transformative Solutions, which is a really remarkable analysis of the problem and bringing forward some very new ideas for dealing with it. And we're getting a lot of traction on this here in California, especially, where we have people across the board and across the aisle, you might say, who are starting to think that maybe government concentration of power over housing and social services may not be the answer for the homeless. Do you have any comments on our initiative here, David?
Beyond Homeless. Well, the policy report, which is quite extensive, has just been released. This is part of a larger project that includes a new documentary that we're going to be premiering soon, and we'll keep everybody posted of that. If anybody is watching today and is not on our list, just send us a note at info@independent.org. We're happy to add you. So this is really the most comprehensive work ever done on the subject. We're using San Francisco as the case study. San Francisco being the city of hypocrisy, of billionaires and people who are dying in the streets. And all in this sort of frame narrative of progressivism. And the contrast that we're doing, sort of a tale of two cities, is comparing what's being done in San Francisco as well as in Los Angeles and Seattle and many, many other cities, New York, whatever, with a group in San Antonio, which has taken quite a different approach. It's a program called Haven for Hope, and they have been successful in reducing homelessness by about 80%. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, homelessness has gone up by about 90%. And what the report shows is that the approach they're using, the more money they put into it, the worse homelessness will be, and the more people will die. So we're showing people really a proven approach that can be done to de-bureaucratize, depoliticize it, and actually have a humane and effective approach that will overcome this problem. And it's perfectly solvable, but we have to get past the mistakes and the false narrative that people have been using.
So we invite you to go to independent.org and take a look at this report on homelessness. There are links there that will keep you informed, and we will be offering to
So the program is called Beyond Homeless, the whole program. The subtitle of it is the Campaign on Housing and Human Dignity.
Right, exactly. And we're grateful for everybody's interest in that and support for it as well. Next week is Thanksgiving. We will, of course, not be here next week. But we have a lot to be thankful for here in the United States of America. I mean, compared to the rest of the world, you know, the rule of law, individual liberty, and all the blessings that come from that are largely intact, especially when you compare ourselves to other places. And we have a lot to be grateful. We want to preserve those good things for everyone and be thankful. And then we'll see you after Thanksgiving in a couple of weeks. Thank you, David. Any final comments?
And also, just in keeping with what you're saying, Graham, I think it's important to note that people are responding in that tradition of America in a very positive way to rein in centralized power and power to the people, basically.
Yeah, I really feel that compared to 2 weeks ago, there's some more reasons for hope that we didn't have a couple weeks ago. Bill, any final comments for you?
No, thank you. Pleasure to participate.
I'm grateful for both of you and for all of our friends who join us. Thanks for tuning in to Independent Outlook. Make sure you make good use of our website. We have a lot of resources for you, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Happy Thanksgiving. Bye-bye, everybody.